of you.
Welcome to Practical Rambling Father. This is Father Brian.
And this is Father Che.
Today with us, we have our guest, Tim Murray, who is in charge of running Trinity Sobriety House. So he's going to share with us his story, how a priest saved his life in his journey. So, Tim, do you want to tell us a little bit about you, and then we can get into your story?
Well, good morning, fathers. It's wonderful to have two priests here. We're coming to you from the St. Isidore Farm, and this is part of the Trinity Sober Home offerings of housing and spiritual development for men in recovery. Colonel Father Martin Fleming saved my life, and Father was the Army General Chaplain under Colton Powell. So all of the Army chaplains in the U.S. Army reported to him, and he reported to General Colin Powell. And so Father was extremely eclectic as well as ecumenical in his approach to people in life. And I showed up on Father's doorstep, a broken, spiritually, emotionally, mentally bankrupt man. I was living in my car. It was a nice car, guys, but I was living in my car. And Father and his King's men put this Humpty Dumpty back together again.
I love that. It's awesome. Great. So where was that? What time frame? What did that look like for you?
Sure. In 2009, I had finally reached what people might refer to as their bottom of drinking. I think I've mentioned to you before that, you know, back when I used to be who I thought I was, I was a big deal. And if you didn't think so, just ask me, I would have told you. And that perspective got me right into the bottom of a bottle because I believed the lie that the world told me, which is that it's my life and I know what's best for me. And I believed the lie that I can live a life based on self-will and self-determination. And frankly, for some period of time, I had the illusion that things actually were being controlled by me, only to find out that they're not. We're actually hearing Father's grandfather clock in the background. So
nice.
This is Father chiming in to remind me to make it about Jesus and not about me.
That's awesome.
I love that.
So Father always talked to us about the centrality of the Jesus event. So when I moved in with Father,
you actually moved in and lived with him for a time.
So Father had, only in St. Paul can three streets make a corner. So if you're familiar with that, the Summit Avenue, so Summit Avenue, I'm trying to blank, Summit Avenue, Western Avenue, and now I can't remember the name of the other street, but basically they come together right across the street from the university club. And he owned basically that whole corner there. So he had taken his pension as a colonel back in the 80s when a lot of those homes were vacant. He fixed them up, and he created what he called Bethany Village.
I didn't know that.
It after Jesus' resting place.
Sure.
And before there was such a thing as sober homes in the Twin Cities, he basically had, there were 30 of us who lived in community with Father, and he was basically the sort of priest of second to 99th chances. And so he enjoyed hanging around people in recovery, and I'm sure as priests you can appreciate this, but what he found is that most parishioners are on their best behavior when they're around a priest, and they try to portray an image that's just not what we're like when we're around our family and friends.
Correct.
Not so true with alcoholics. So one of Father's favorite stories was to tell when he was interviewing somebody to live in the house, and he said, well, you know, how did you get to this place where you need some place to live? And he said the first thing out of the guy's mouth was, well, Father, after my sixth felony and... So he said he just loved hanging around people in recovery because of the raw honesty and the raw truth And he also was the chaplain for the women's prison in Shakopee for about 20 years.
Wow. Okay.
So I think he just really had a ministry for the redemption of broken souls.
Sure.
So did Father run this home by himself? Did he have any helpers at all during that time?
Or? Yeah, so he had a couple people on staff. Okay. But, you know, as a colonel, one of the things you learn about Father... He passed here in 2018 at the age 92. But when I met him, he was in his, you know, would have been in his early to mid 80s. And in every conversation, the best way to describe Father is he 99% channeled Jesus, and the colonel always made his appearance in the conversation. Like the 1 o'clock cuckoo, the colonel would show up, and there would be great clarity. And great authority would have been spoken. So he was a big believer in the Benedictine notion of may your yes mean yes, but in particular, may your no mean no.
Mm-hmm.
There was, it was a complete sentence when Father said no.
Mm. It was a complete sentence.
I love that's awesome.
No. Oh, okay. What is it? Cardinal Dolan has a famous line of, that's a great idea, and no, we're not doing it.
100%.
But, yeah, so showing up, talking with Father, this little intake. So he had an intake interview with you,
yep.
too?
And And during that, and during our conversations, he said, you know, Tim, I appreciate our fellow Irish jocularity. However... I'm afraid it may get in the way of some needed intimate conversation. So I'm going to suggest an arrangement. Are you game? And of course, at the time when you're homeless and you're looking for a place to live, you say yes to anything. So I said, sure, Father, I'm game. He said, I'll tell you what. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to leave my collar at the door. If you're willing to leave your ego at the door... And I think this is going to be a lot harder for one of us than the other. And I said, that's a deal. So that started just the most loving, wonderful relationship I've ever had outside my father, who passed here, you know, 30 some years ago. So it was just marvelous. Father liked to mix his military and Catholic terms.
Sure.
So after living with him for about 6 months, and by the way, if he were here, he would say, you know, gentlemen, that Tim lived with me for 2 years, which of course was the longest 10 years of my life.
What a riot.
Oh, yeah, he was great. Man. But Father said, after about 6 months and starting to believe that maybe some of the stories I was telling him about my background might actually be true, he said... Tim, and by the way, when you went to meet with Father, you knew it was a long, there's no such thing as a short conversation, by the way, you know, but you knew it was going to be longer in particular, which usually meant 45 minutes or more if there was a candle that was lit. And, you know, for a tip for your readers or listeners, I've actually tried this in business and it works. And I said, Father, just out of curiosity, why the candle? He said, it softens the sharp edges of conflict. And so I was in a business meeting one time when I knew it was going to be a contentious conversation. And I, without saying anything, I just took a candle out and I lit it, and it just had this, you know, spiritual effect without saying anything. And so it's a trick I've learned from him, or at least not necessarily a trick, but I guess a method. Of infusing spirituality without necessarily having to be in people's faces with it. But he sat me down and he said, Tim, I've received inside word that my transfer papers to purgatory are being processed, and I'd like you to join me on a 35-year mission to roll out a series of authentically Catholic sober houses. And then the colonel appeared. What do you think? And I said, well, Father, I don't know if you recall, but we, you know, I probably told you before, I'm kind of a big deal. And, you know, I don't know. But I'll tell you what, it's been working pretty well. And this is the first time I've been sober for this long. So I'll tell you what, Father, And of course, this was me trying to box in Father. Bad idea.
Did not.
I said, I'll tell you what, Father, if you give me one really good reason, give me one really good reason why I should do this, I'll do it. Without even hesitating. And you could just tell the Holy Spirit just flowed right through him. He looked me right in the eye with those steely blue eyes, and he said, Tim, as I have done for you, go forth and do for others.
Wow.
And all I was thinking to myself was, dang, that's a really good reason.
That's yes.
a good one.
Yes.
Can't get out of that.
Yeah.
The other was, if the subtleties, and this is how smart Father was at the time I was 52 and he was 87 when we had that conversation.
Okay. Wow. Yeah.
Now, he chose 35 knowing that I was going to do the math in my head, because my initial reaction after I said, boy, that's a really good reason, I almost said, well, Father, 35 years, I can't, you know, I'll be eight. Oh, wait a second, that's how old he is. That's how, you know,
yeah.
He cut me off right at the pass.
Wow.
So I'm now 13 years into my 35-year commitment, so I only have 22 years to go, gentlemen.
There you go.
Nice. Well done.
Just getting started.
Right.
Love it.
Yeah.
Love it. So Father's the one that kind of inspired all the houses and stuff.
Yeah, so Father, we basically at Trinity Sober Homes, so we now have 55 old beds, which includes the St. Isidore Farm where you're here at today.
Mm-hmm.
We have three buildings, three wonderful Victorian homes up in the Twin Cities. Think of them as bed and breakfast Victorians.
Mm-hmm.
We fixed up, and each man has their own private room.
Wow.
And we've now had over 450 men that we've provided housing for. And gentlemen, I'm going to shock you with revelation, but did you know that we have the highest post-treatment recovery rate in the nation at 71%? And here's the shock.
Wow.
Invite God into your business model and you get superior results.
Mm.
Who knew?
Who knew?
That's awesome. Yeah.
Who knew?
I didn't see that one coming.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
Somebody said that once.
Mm-hmm. So we provide spiritual coaching for all of our men, and that was really Father's experience with all of us. So those of you who are listening, maybe as you're a lay person, maybe you're in clergy, you know, I have to say, I think I'm a really good example of what happens when one priest spends time with one person. Because he had no idea what was going to happen. He just simply planted a seed and said, hey, I think if we were to get him to be really honest, I think he would say, this hotshot might actually be able to do what he says he's going to do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Let's find out.
Yeah, sure.
Mm.
And one of the things that Father really emphasized to us all the time was what he called the centrality of the Jesus event. The centrality of the Jesus event. And when I asked him, I said, you know, give me a little bit more context.
Yeah.
Right? And he said, well, first of all, our entire timeline of time, we reference around the centrality of the Jesus event. It's either before or after. Second is, he said that every successful ministry, Protestant or Catholic, places Jesus at the center, and that's what sustains. And that the main reason that the Catholic Church has withstood all of the knuckleheads that have been involved with it is not because of anything other than it is has Jesus at the center, just like the Mass, just like the altar.
Right.
So what he reminded us was to always keep Jesus at the center of what we're doing. But he also admonished us, because I know, Father, you won't find this hard to believe, but I really enjoy listening to myself talk. And so he said,
we all do.
Frequently, he said, go forth and preach the gospel. And then he would look at me and he said, and you in particular, do not use words.
Sharp man.
In particular.
He did not mince his words.
Oh.
Yeah.
You in particular, just do actions. Oh, okay.
Right. So over that 13 years, we've now grown to the point where we basically are perpetuating or continuing the model or the experience that I had with Father, which is live in a dignified home. Father's a big believer that the dignity of human beings doesn't begin to be either instilled or restored until you live in a dignified environment. So housing isn't just enough. It's not like here's a double-decker cardboard box.
Right.
It's dignified housing that then gets human beings to say, well, my life circumstances might not be that great right now, but at least I don't live in a horrible living environment.
A car.
Correct.
Right. Yeah. Like a car.
Like a car.
Like a car.
Like somebody. Like somebody at one point.
And so our homes, first and foremost, now he was also a very pragmatic, smart guy. So this is where the colonel would show up. He also, like we charge well below market value to live in our homes. And I remember living with him one day, excuse me. I remember living with him and I asked, hey, father, it seems to me that there's a strategic reason why you charge less than what these homes are living with you at Bethany Village. These are beautiful old Victorian homes, and you're only charging, you know, at that time it was like, I think, $400 a month to live there.
Oh, wow.
And I said, is there a strategy behind that? And again, yes.
Just one sentence.
Yes. Okay, me.
Elaborate more. On that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I said, may I ask you to tell me what that strategy is? No.
Wow.
I said, okay, can I guess? Yes. So I said, let me guess. The reason that you charge below market value is because nobody is going to come to you and complain about anything, because the only leverage that a tenant has is to say, well, I can go get someplace nicer than this for the same price.
Sure.
And so my guess is you've got leverage over them, because nobody is ever going to say that living here in this beautiful home at this price. And he looked at me, he goes, you might actually be as smart as you're saying you are.
That's wonderful.
You might actually have here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's good. So what was the transition like between, you know, life before, you know, working the steps and then into working sobriety, like, and working recovery? Like, what was that, like, spiritual experience, but even, like, just that practical shift of life? What does it look like to shift that from, like, the spiritual side, obviously, working the steps, but then also into, like, recovery and what that looks like to grow as a human, you know?
So there's a couple of factors there. The first is that, you know, I was born and raised Catholic. I was an altar boy. My aunt was a nun over the Sisters of Carondelet. My great uncle was Monsignor Murray. He built St. Leo's Church, which is now Christi Lumen in St. Paul. And so I don't know what else to be other than to be Catholic.
Sure. Mm.
Now, when I was sitting with Father, I said, you know, I'm very embarrassed, Father, and I hadn't been in church for probably 20 years, or if I did, it was a C&E, you know, Catholic. And I just remember, you know, very embarrassingly saying, you know, Father, I, you know, I've been married 3 times. I've probably committed just about every sin other than murder. And I just don't think I'd be welcome, or I'm really embarrassed. And he just reached across and he touched my arm, and, you know, I remember I can just, you know, like he was sitting here right now, and all he said was, he said, Tim, the church is a hospital for sinners. It is not a museum for saints. And the angels in heaven will rejoice when you're ready to come back.
Wonderful.
And so I started going to Mass. We only lived about, Father lived about less than a mile away from the cathedral.
Okay, sure.
So I walked down and I went to Mass basically every single day. And somewhere in there, my inner Catholic woke up, which really fed the spiritual. It was like a super rocket fuel to my 12-step program.
Okay.
I also went out to De Montreville, which is a Jesuit retreat, which is like one big, huge 11th step on steroids. The 11th step in AA is sought through prayer and medication.
Something else.
Oh, that's a Freudian slip.
That's wrong.
Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out.
Correct. Right.
Mm-hmm. And in that process, I started to, with I guess maybe an overly zealous personality, basically realize that I am unapologetically and unabashedly Catholic.
Hmm.
And that when he asked me to help him start Trinity Sober Homes,
mm-hmm.
we've just been sort of unapologetically and unabashedly Catholic. And
sure.
in the spirit of small c, which is universal, mm-hmm. you know, we really view what we're doing as corporal works of mercy. Mm. So we don't care if you're Catholic.
Correct.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Jesus wasn't.
Right.
So... you know, you don't have to be Catholic to live with us. You just have to believe that there is a higher power.
Okay.
And mm-hmm. it's not named Brian.
Right.
Right.
It's not the ego.
So, right. and I'll tell you, we probably reject guys one out of every three applicants who are not there yet.
Oh, okay.
So we're really known as the spiritual or the Jesus guys. And while we don't push a particular agenda in the recovery world, right?
Yeah, sure,
and while we don't push a particular agenda, Father was very clear that we don't convert by the sword.
Mm-hmm.
But what we do is we say, look, there is a higher power.
Mm.
There is clarity that it's not you based on how well you've effed up your life.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a thought. Why don't you come in here and mm-hmm. explore?
Yeah.
Now, you guys know the secret weapon. Which, of course, is the Holy Spirit. So anybody who becomes a spiritual seeker
mm-hmm.
always ends up at the foot of the cross. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have literally never heard somebody said, I went on a spiritual journey and I landed in Tibet. Now, they may have visited there,
mm-hmm.
right.
but they don't stay there, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I never hear anybody that says, I went on a spiritual journey and I landed at the foot of the Buddha in Kyoto. Now, they might have visited there.
Correct.
I've been there.
Yep.
But the magnetic pull of the cross,
right,
pulls us. And so our job is just to start them on that journey.
Sure.
And that's really what we do at Trinity Sober Homes.
Did you find, like, a shift between, like, growing up Catholic and then, like, working? Like, I like how you said that it's, the like, the fuel. But did you feel like it was, like, a... I don't know, like a shift to the mindset of a higher power and like how, mm-hmm. like I thought I surrendered as a kid to the Lord or as going to church, like all that stuff. And then like mm-hmm. as an adult doing step work was like an entirely different way of surrendering, like, you know.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is generational. I've heard both of you guys give homilies, and I think you guys do, you know, at the risk of sounding ungrateful, I think you do a much better job than the... priests of the 60s and the possibly the 70s. And that's partly because I think there was a really heavy emphasis. You know, I went to Our Lady of the Lake, got kicked out for pushing Sister Imelda into the swamp, but that's a different story. That's a future indicator.
We'll write that down.
Yeah.
And we're going to circle back to that.
That's hilarious.
That's a future indicator of a member of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah.
it's a predictor. But I would say that we had a very good intellectual understanding of the faith.
Sure.
But I think there was even a movement for a while there in the 60s to suggest that, one, we don't put the Bible in the mm-hmm. hands of the lay, you know, God forbid, only the priests are really right. supposed to interpret.
Mm-hmm.
So there was discouragement to get involved in what many of my Protestant brothers and sisters got involved with, which was the Jesus movement, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the challenge then became, so do I believe there's a God? Yeah, of course, you know. But as I was chugging my booze
mm-hmm.
and committing all kinds of sins, I was like, yeah, who doesn't know there's a God? I mean, you know, just look mm-hmm. at the evidence.
Yeah, 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 right.
Now, if you were to ask me, do you think you have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ? I would go, I think that's for the Baptists,
mm-hmm.
you know. Mm-hmm. We don't do that.
We don't use those words.
Yeah, you know, we don't talk like
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so for me, what happened was this bridge got built between my intellectual understanding and my comfort with the rituals and routines of the Catholic Church, and all of a sudden now this wonderful bridge called the 12 Steps got created, which is, hey, I actually now have access to that power. I can tap into that power. And that power can actually keep me from drinking on a daily basis. Like, hey, that's super cool. I want to explore this power some more.
Yep.
So it was an invitation to do, you know, things like this, right? Right. So I'm holding a book called Divine Therapy and Addiction by Thomas Keating, who basically is a priest and a brother and, you know, basically invented centering prayer, or at least is, you know, sort of talks a lot about that. So all of these tools that have been around our faith for 1,000 years that many like you who have access to, whether it's in monasteries, whether it's in seminary or in the brotherhood of priests, have not been made really available to many of us in the laity.
Yeah.
And that's why we're a laity-run organization, because one, Father said we need to be priest-light because you guys are, you know, overly burdened.
Yes.
And second is that he said, look, you guys can screw up as much as a priest can, so why don't you guys just do it?
Hey, there you go.
Right?
100%.
You know, and that way we don't bring any bad name to the Catholic Church.
Sure.
You know, because there was enough bad press yeah. particularly at that time.
Correct.
You know, with the sex scandal and the children.
Sure.
So he said, why don't we try to be some good PR for the church? And we have been.
Yeah. No, that's awesome.
Yeah, I love what you said earlier about, you know, that type of fear of having a personal relationship with God. Like, you know, I used to be stationed here out in Waseca, and I had some, you know, it's just some people are so afraid, you know, like you know how like sometimes they say, you know, I have a problem when you're constantly denying it, right? Do you think that shame is a big part of the fear? People realize they know they have a problem, but yet they're not quite committed to getting those steps. What would you say to someone like that? You know, like their wives are talking about, the children know, it's all kind of like a hush-hush secret.
Yeah. Well, I think the big challenge with the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction is it's the only disease known to man that convinces you you don't have it. So, for example, when you have an elbow hurts, pain is what's telling your head, hey, Father, knucklehead, go do something about this. And then if you choose to ignore it, which a lot of alcoholics and drug addicts do, the pain gets worse. You eventually get pain enough where you're going to say, you know, maybe I should go make an appointment to the doctor and take care of my elbow. Alcoholism, unfortunately, for some mysterious reason, is a soul sickness, and as a result, the only solution is a spiritual one. You know, in our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about that you may be suffering from a malady or a sickness, which only a spiritual experience will conquer.
Wow.
But try to tell me, you know, a big shot that works on Wall Street who's a drunk, that I've got a soul sickness, and you might, you know, get a broken nose.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, correct.
So the reality is that for people who are family members of and love somebody who's in the throes of their addiction, Al-Anon has what's called the three C's, which is you didn't cause this.
Yeah.
You can't change this. And most importantly, you can't control it. So people will try carrot, they'll try stick. And the reality is that until I had enough pain, and you would think living in your car would be enough pain. Nope. Right? You would think that having three women, not one, not two, but three women say, I'm done, would be enough.
Right.
You know, Father asked me one time, he said, I'm just curious, whose name shows up the most frequently on the front page of your three divorce decrees? And I said, me? He said, probably. I said, so what, you're telling me I'm the problem? He said, well, I'm not telling you anything. I'm just asking you questions. It's up to you to figure out the answers.
I'm just here.
Right?
Wow, that's a poignant question.
Who's the common denominator?
Three.
Man, that man has a gift for this ministry. You could tell he loved you, but he knew when to push, right? Okay. He met you. Yeah, that's awesome.
So I think that for those who are struggling with a loved one, the best thing to do is set boundaries. And consequences won't stop us from drinking, but consequences are the only thing that will get somebody's attention. So, for example, in our sober homes, you know, I have to admit, even Father had a hard time with this because he worked closely with a couple of other elders that were in the AA community. And Father deferred to them on topics like discipline and accountability.
Oh, sure, sure.
Because his passion would be to give somebody a second chance.
Right.
Mm. Our perspective is no. So when you drink, so guys, we have this really radical thought. You ready? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
We think that everybody in a sober house ought to be
sober. Question?
Weird. Question mark?
Why?
What?
What?
So, when you relapse...
Why would I want to be that?
When you relapse,
yeah.
You got to go. And I don't care if it's 2 o'clock in the morning and it's 30 below outside, you got to go.
You got to go. Okay.
Because, you know, as Spock said, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we can't keep you in a house that's supposed to be a sober house while you're drunk.
Yeah.
You got to go. Yeah, and that's a universal rule of all well-run sober houses.
Sure.
Father's tendency would be to say, we'll give the guy another chance.
Yep.
And our perspective is, great, we'll give him another chance in 2 to 3 weeks.
Right.
If we like him and he's willing to surrender to the rules.
Yeah.
So usually with a loved one, there have to be consequences. Now, this is a tough part as priests, because you've got to, you know, you're in a difficult position where it could be 10 more years before that individual reaches the bottom I did.
Right, right.
But the safety of the wife, of the spouse, the safety of the children has to come before the health of the addicted one.
Right.
So when wives call me and they ask, what should I do?
Mm-hmm.
I just say, kick the SOB out.
Yeah. Mm.
It's that simple.
Yeah.
Because, you know, well, I can't do that. He might die. He's going to die anyways.
Mm.
Okay? It's just going to be a long, slow, painful death.
Right.
We know that alcoholism is a progressive, fatal disease.
Yeah.
Mm.
So the only chance that anybody has is there have to be consequences. And then the problem is that there's this linked issue of finances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they might be the breadwinner of the house. So it's a very complicated, tough issue. But eventually, it's like, I'm sure you guys have flown on airplanes. What do they tell you about the oxygen masks?
Put on yourself first before you can do it for someone else.
Right. Yep. So the wife, the kids,
yeah.
they have to put their oxygen mask on first
mm-hmm.
right. if they're going to be of any chance to be of help for the alcoholic or the drug addict.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was listening to a podcast, Sobercast.
Mm-hmm.
It's a podcast. Somebody mm-hmm. put me onto it. And there's a priest Jesuit that's 37 years sober. Anyways, but one of his phrases is like, don't get in the cage with the gorilla to vacuum.
Right. Like, right.
When your loved one's in the middle of it, they're riding with a gorilla right now. Don't try to step into that space and go like, I just want a vacuum.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Stay out of the cage. Stay out of the zoo.
I like that. Our version of that is watch the movie. Don't be in the movie.
Sure.
Nice.
Don't add yourself as another character in this drama, which only then manifests. It's basically like throwing gas on a fire.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm. What is so you're talking about your, like, the own ego. Is that like as you've worked with a few different generations by now in these houses, like, is that kind of the main higher power that people can't get over is
correct.
Having them be the source of themselves, the goodness of the, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the challenge is, you know, one of the definitions we use for ego is edging God out.
Mm.
And
edging God out, okay.
I love that.
Mm. And I would argue that the 12-step program is really nothing more than an ego management program.
Yeah.
And it's helping to remind me of really three things. One, that there's a creator, which makes me creature. So there is a God and it's not me.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And that starting place is a very different starting place than most people have when they start their day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I start my day by what I've been taught by both you guys and the 12 steps,
mm-hmm.
is I get on my knees and I acknowledge again today, hey, I woke up like an alcoholic again today. Weird.
Yes.
I'm still an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I go down. There's two alleys or two hallways in life. There's the non-alcoholic hallway and there's the alcoholic hallway.
Mm.
In the non-alcoholic hallway, there's a lot of things on the menu there when you go down that hallway that isn't on the menu if I go down the alcoholic hallway.
Right.
Mm-hmm. My choice My free will allows me to say, which hallway am I going to go down today?
Right. Mm.
And during the day, there are all these little exit ramps that allow me to go back over to the non-alcoholic hallway if I want to.
Right.
To which the greatest question that those of us love to ask but hate to be asked, which is, you ready for it, guys? Because trust me, you can use this one. Ready?
Yeah. What do we got?
What we got?
How's that working for you?
That's my favorite.
Yes.
That is one of my favorite questions. Right?
Yep.
Are you trying to control everything? How's that going for you?
Right.
Oh, he does to me all the time because I'm a huge perfectionist. He's like, huh. Sucks. Yeah, sucks as in you're perfect. In I'm like, broken, shut up.
Yeah. In a broken, fallen world, you want to be perfect.
Shut up, man.
Okay. That sounds hard.
Yeah. So, you know, bringing this full circle, what Father Fleming did for me was to show me really those three components that we try to work on in our houses with our men. The first is the centrality of the Jesus event, or in other words, more simplistically, there is a God and it's not you, Tim. Mm. Okay? Sure. The second is you have to clean up the wreckage of the past. So Father would talk about that the biggest challenge that most churches have is there's too much programming going on.
Yeah.
And people don't like to hear this because it's like, well, we expect our, you know, programming. Well, Father would be like, well, okay, how's that working for your church? Right?
Yeah, right, yes. Exactly.
And usually it wasn't.
Correct.
And so what we have learned is that if you think about that, there's the spark of the divine within all of us. You know, Jesus said, the kingdom of God is within you, right? There's this spark of the divine within all of us. Those of us who have acknowledged it, we've really just covered up that spark of the divine with all kinds of sin, all kinds of crap, all kinds of bad stuff that we've done, which ultimately is self, which is selfish and self-centeredness.
Right. Yeah.
So whether it's confession or the steps or working the sacraments, it really allows us to strip away that gunk and expose this tiny little ember, like a tiny little coal. And what Father learned and taught us was that whether it was in seminary or in the military, that first of all, you have to bring these men together, strip away their differences, strip away their special and unique snowflake elements, and focus on the more common goal. And then here's the magic. Just about the time you bring all of these little tiny coals together, somebody wants to do programming, so they'll take like lighter fluid and spray them on the coals and then douse them, and then they can't figure out what's going on.
Yeah, right.
Rather, what he said was, no. Stop. Bring those coals together. Step back. And then watch this. Let the breath of the Holy Spirit, poof, ignite a flame of community.
Right.
And that's what happens in our houses. Mm-hmm. So rather than worrying about whether or not Brian's going to care about feeding the kids in Africa, which is probably important stuff, Father would say, I'm more interested in Brian getting out of his bedroom, walking down the hallway and saying, hey, Charlie, how you doing today?
Right.
What can I do to help you?
100%.
So being of service to others. So we talk about the 12 steps of AA can really be boiled down to 6 words. You ready?
Yes.
Trust God. Clean house. Help others.
Sure.
So service work or being of service to others is critical to my sobriety and everybody I know who's working what we would call a good program or do unto the least of my brothers, anybody who's trying to be a good Christian, they're out doing corporal works of mercy.
100%. Right?
They're helping other people. And in this creative way that God designed us, I get this really special, tingly, wonderful feeling that I desired in drugs and alcohol. But I get this high when I actually help others. So God's like, here's me. There's a good ego. Me complimenting God. You know, that guy was a pretty good designer.
Yeah,
I did. He did a good job.
Yeah, he did a good job, right? But think about the brilliance of this, which is the greatest feeling I can get is helping somebody else.
100%.
Particularly if I don't tell anybody about it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's the high that all of us chased.
Yep.
That we now get access to, if we want to get access to it.
Yeah.
But you got to do the other stuff first. You got to clear away the wreckage of the past. You got to acknowledge that there is a higher power and it's not me.
Yeah.
And you have to let go of this silly notion that I think for a lot of us came out of the 60s, which is, it's my life and I know what's best
good
for me.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
To which Father said,
"Do you?
How's that working good for you?"
I love that. That's awesome.
That, yeah.
And it sounds like, you know, Father gave you a lot of hope too, right? He walked with you. He understood the pain. So what were some things, you know, like just hearing the story really inspires me. What type of things can we do better, like as a priest? Like, for example, let's say a priest comes to us exactly like your story. Like, Father, I am at the last rope. Like, what are some things that we can do as priests to help a man or a woman who's come to that point, you know?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think the first is to acknowledge, and you guys have probably already know this, but for you guys to acknowledge that you are, just like the rest of us, you are 100% powerless over that person's disease and their willingness to make some decisions.
Right.
And the second is that when I've been involved in interventions, which is basically what you're talking about, which is my life is heading this way.
Mm-hmm.
I see the end. The end is not good. Father, can you help me out?
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that if I look at what Father Fleming did for me and many others, is, you know, maybe a little tougher than what you might want to hear.
Sure.
Which is basically to ask over and over and over again, you know, how is this working for you? And Father used to ask this great sort of series of very logical questions, which is, how satisfied are you with the results you're getting in your life? So let's just role play here. So,
sure.
Father, how satisfied are you with the results you're getting in your life, right?
Yeah, I'd say pretty good.
Okay, now, let's put yourself in the chair of this parishioner that's come in that's really near the bottom.
Yeah.
So you play the role of that person.
Will do, okay.
And I would say, okay, Billy, how satisfied are you with the results you're getting in your life?
It could be better.
Okay, so on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 is that my life is horrible, and 10 is my life is perfect. Where would you say you're at on the number?
Ah, shoot. Maybe 4?
Yeah, if I would say if there are 1, 2, or 3, you got a shot. I think anything more than that, you would say, you know what, I'll tell you what, why don't you come back to me when you're more miserable? Because one of the definitions of God is gift of desperation. Because human beings won't change unless they're motivated to do so.
Right.
And we're all, like it or not, we're all pain-based learners.
Yeah. Mm.
So God's gift to us is pain, right? If you read any of Father, okay, I'm drawing a blank here. I was trying to show off with my...
it's all good.
Henry Nouwen and his Wounded Healer, he talks about God entering
us
through our wounds.
Correct, yep, okay? Yep.
Now, if somebody says, you know, Father, I'm a 1, 2, or 3,
they're
great. So,
I have a group we should go to.
What I'm hearing you say, Billy, is your life really right now, we have this theological term, it's called sucks. Your life sucks. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, great.
I do believe that's a theological term.
So, your life sucks. So, let me ask you something. Do you think that in order for, do you want your life to get a little bit better, or do you want your life to get a whole lot better?
Whole lot better.
Great. So in order for it to get a whole lot better, did you know, first of all, right now, your life is perfectly designed to get the results you're getting? So in other words, if you always do what you always did, you'll always get what you always got.
Mm-hmm.
So, Billy, I got a question for you.
Sure.
Do you think in order to get a whole lot better,
mm-hmm.
do you think you need to do just a little bit of change in your life? Or do you think you have to do a whole lot of change in your life?
Whole lot.
Got it. Okay, so, you know, maybe, Billy, the thing we're going to do is we're just going to stop doing everything you're doing right now, and we're just going to do the opposite for like a day.
Nice.
So one of those would be, can you not drink for the next 24 hours? That would be opposite of what you're currently doing, right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
And then maybe be nice to your wife or your kids. That's probably the opposite of what you're doing right now, right?
Correct, yeah.
And then how about show up to work on time? That's probably opposite of what you're doing right now, if you even still have a job.
Exactly, right? Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So why don't, just for 24 hours,
just
let's see if you're capable of doing the opposite.
Hmm.
Now, one of two things will happen. They'll actually start to get better results, which you can then encourage them to go to a local 12-step meeting.
Sure, yeah.
Or if they're like most of us, they'll be like, they made it to like maybe a half an hour after they left, and they went back to those.
Yeah,
right? Sure.
To which you now have a person that basically, unless they have a profound willingness to submit to treatment or some other power greater than themselves, right?
Yeah.
Some therapist, some process like the 12 steps or others, they got no chance. And I'm sure you guys have a special sort of theological category for those of us who are just, you know, we're screwed. But, you know, whatever that category is, there's other than a Paul Saul experience.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
They're going to die.
Sure.
Yep. Yeah.
And so the first thing I would say is, you know, first of all, give them my phone number, right? Have them call me. But my approach will be very similar, which is, well, how willing are you to change?
Yeah.
And until that willingness is there, nothing can happen. I had to get to the point where I was so willing. I was actually willing. How bad is this? I was willing to come back to the Catholic Church. Unbelievable.
Crazy.
Right.
Who would have thought that?
Right. But that was the opposite of what I was doing.
Good point.
Which was not going to Mass. Right?
Can you break down, what's the phrase? Resentment kills more alcoholics than alcohol?
Yeah, I've heard that,
That phrase, like, what is that? Because I don't know that. First off, I think everyone should be in 12 steps. Anyways.
Yeah. Second, I've heard that before.
I think everyone should be working some 12 step. So resentment kills more alcoholics than alcohol. I'm just curious, like, what is that? How does that come about, and why is that the malady, if we want to call it the malady of the soul, of an addictive personality, and what that looks like?
Yeah, well, I think that for most of us alcoholics and addicts, we're just clay-footed sinners like everybody else. It's just that somehow, in some way, God gave us this gift of extra character defects.
Sure.
So my character defenses are no different category-wise, you know, the seven deadly sins.
Right, exactly.
It's just that some of us got like a 2 or 3X on some of those in terms of the amount.
Sure.
Sure.
So, Father, you saw me here reach for our big book, so I'm just going to read to you a couple sentences.
Got the big
book
out. The 18-wheeler.
Nice.
So you had asked me the question about resentments, right?
Yeah.
So how weird is this? You know, probably doesn't relate. Books written in 1939, just a long shot.
Long shot.
Totally
no
long
idea.
Shot.
Can't.
I'm just going to randomly pick something. You ready?
Yep.
Got it.
Resentments is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we have not been only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We found ourselves, and we asked why we were angry. In most cases, we found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, and our personal relationships were affected. This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended us, we said to ourselves, God, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. So resentments are really nothing more than expectations. And an expectation is a resentment in waiting. So if
interesting. I've never heard it said that
way. That's awesome.
Yeah. So a resentment is an expectation is a premeditated resentment. If I expect you to behave in a certain way and you don't, then I'm going to get upset with you.
Yep.
A classic example would be in a relationship. If I give you a gift, and let's say I go out and spend all kinds of time and energy, I do some research and I give you a gift.
Yep.
And I think this is I put a lot of time and effort into this, and look at how well I wrapped this. What is my expectation of your response or reaction to getting and opening this gift?
That I'm going to absolutely love it.
Yeah,
love
over the top.
And, like, embrace you.
Right. And let's say, for whatever reason, you don't do that.
Right.
Yeah.
What's my most common response going to be?
Angry. Pissed off.
Yeah, that ungrateful SOB.
Right.
That's the last effing thing I'm ever going to give that.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, You came into this interaction just showing up to have coffee with me.
Right.
Right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Did you come in with the objective of, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to really try to find a way to tick Tim off today. Right?
Yeah. No, you know, no. I really want to do that.
Yeah, I really
I go around ticking off people.
Yeah, that's what and yeah. Oh, here's an opportunity. He's giving me a gift. Watch this. I'm going to intentionally have a muted response and then watch his head explode. Yeah.
No other thing.
Says no one ever.
Yeah.
Ever.
Right?
But we have expectations. You know, the Buddhists talk about suffering is defined as the distance between where I am and where I want to be on any given topic. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if my weight is not where I want it to be, I'm dissatisfied. I have an expectation that I weigh less, but I don't. If my income, my housing situation, mm-hmm. the behavior of my children, the behavior of my boss, yeah. the driving habits of others on the road, there's this list. And when people start to realize it, and we do that in the 12 steps, we have guys write down these expectations, and yeah. all of a sudden you start to realize, man, I got expectations of everybody and everything, including myself, and mm-hmm. nobody's doing them.
Exactly.
You're all falling short.
Right, yeah, yep. yeah, yeah.
Yep. Sure.
So, how's that working for you?
How's
dang
that going
it.
For you?
Yeah.
Are you in control?
So, yeah. what we've learned is that I can't lower my expectations fast enough. Now, this is like most great spiritual is in the paradox, right? I have to die in order to live. I have to give up in order to get. So, how do we give up expectations without having expectations? Well, the way we do it is we don't emotionally invest in the outcome. Mm. So, I can have an expectation of you as a priest to follow your orders, but if you don't, I can be spiritually neutral and say, well, that's disappointing. Okay, so here are the consequences, but I'm going to love you anyways.
Right.
Versus, I can't believe, you know, blood, right?
Yeah.
Now, the problem is most people on big things, they might be able to do that. But the reality is they've got, all of us, have all of these expectations. Like I had a guy who was, I expected him to show up yesterday to help me at 10 o'clock, and he didn't. And silly me, I had an expectation that he would actually do what he said he was going to do when he said he was going to do it.
Yeah, weird. Huh.
So apparently, now, here's the question. Did he show up? No.
Correct.
So was my expectation realistic? No.
No.
So do you want to go through life having unrealistic expectations only to be perpetually disappointed by people who are underperforming?
Right.
Mm.
And so each person has to work out this paradox, but what I've learned is I can still have expectations of your behavior as long as I'm not emotionally invested in the outcome.
Sure.
Correct.
So if you don't show up, first of all, okay, Tim, he's not a slave. Yeah. He said he would. And most people's response is, well, I would never do that. I mean, if I gave a commitment, I would show up.
Yep.
Would you, though?
Well, yeah. actually, yeah. you know, at least sober, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. right. Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
but here's what Father would said to me, because I had some wonderful knockdown, drag out debates with him.
I love
And
that.
I would say, Father, but I would never do that. He'd go, are we talking about you or everybody else? And I said, well, everybody else. Well, then why don't you just shut up?
Yeah.
Because I think we're talking about your resentments towards others.
Not you.
Exactly. And of course, you're like,
dang it.
How does he have these one-liners? Oh, it's ready.
Box. Yeah. So resentments are the number one offenders because I have expectations of everything in this world. I have expectations of how this country should be run. I have expectations about how the local municipalities ought to make decisions. I have expectations of politicians and priests should be honest, good people. And they're just not always that way.
Right.
And so my sponsor, and I love to say it to my guys, but you know, he'll constantly say, I'll say something and, and he'll say, Tim, I'm surprised you're surprised.
Right. Yeah.
So let me get this right. What's that book, Romans? And there's a 3 and then a 2 and a 3 for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God? Mm-hmm. There's no asterisk there.
Right.
There's no drop-down box that says except...
Except the perfect.
Except for me.
Me.
Whoever they are. Yeah, right.
Exactly. Right? So if all have sinned and fall short of glory... if all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, then why do I have these expectations that you're going to be perfect?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. That just reminds me of the there's a fellow that we're talking about, and he said sober, the abbreviation of sober is SOB, everything's real.
Yeah.
Like, just what does it look like to live in reality on reality's terms versus living in reality in my own times?
Right. We talk about that there are really just two forms. Most human beings are driven by two forms of fear, ultimately. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid if you're going to get in the way of something I want, or you're going to take away something I have.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the two essence of expectations.
Yeah. Interesting.
So if I can help you understand, or the program, or through your faith, understand that, look, God loves us unconditionally.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have responsibilities to our fellows. Correct. At the same time, if I expect you to somehow be better because you're a priest, mm-hmm. well, I'm the idiot.
Right.
And all you got to do is hang around you too long enough to know that's just silly.
Yep.
Silly.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah. Just hang out.
Yep.
But either through conditioning or my own set of probably ill-advised beliefs,
mm-hmm.
I place certain people in a position where my expectations of them are higher than they should be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is going to sound pejorative, but it makes the point is, I spent 50 years of my life running around expecting midgets to be tall.
Sure. That's a good way to say it.
Yeah.
And then I got mad at them.
For not being tall.
Right.
Yeah.
Who does that? Apparently an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So indeed, resentments are the number one offender. It really boils down to if you eliminate expectations, you know, the Jesuits, right, talk about, you know, I pray for neither wealth nor poor. I pray for neither sickness or health. Right. I just pray to be. Mm. Well, that's about as detached and that's about as zero expectation as you can get.
Sure.
Like, I don't have expectations. Like, I'm sick.
Yeah.
Well, what? So your expectation was you're going to be healthy? Where'd that come from?
Yep.
How smart is that?
Yeah.
Yep.
Don't human beings get sick?
Doesn't that happen?
Doesn't that happen? But you not to me. Blood. Oh. So you're special.
You're the asterisk.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were the asterisk.
Because you're super bad. Yeah.
I just, that just reminds me of St. Paul when he says, you know, I don't judge. I don't judge you. I don't judge me. Not saying that I'm judge free. Like, you know, I'm letting the Lord judge this.
Right.
I'm not saying I'm better than you. I'm not saying I'm worse than you. I'm just saying, like, not that anything's on my conscience to be judged on, but like,
this is where I'm at.
Just like that whole entire being able to live in that surrendered spirit as the Lord would have me be is how I want to be.
Yeah, and I also like when Paul talks about, you know what, here's the reality, guys. I do stuff I don't want to do, and I don't do the stuff I should do.
100%.
And if you read it, there's a level of acceptance that, you know what, that's what a clay-footed sinner does.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I'm sorry, but here's the deal. I don't do the stuff I want to.
Mm-hmm.
And I do the stuff I don't want to.
Uh-huh.
But hey, we got some great news. We got a guy named Jesus that can fix that.
Yeah,
100%.
Right? Because on my own, think about the miserable life that he would have led, or would any of us would lead, if we're constantly running around doing stuff we don't want to do,
uh-huh.
and then not doing stuff we do want to do, and not having an understanding of the context of it.
Why would we do that? Right.
So that's where those expectations and misery and resentments come from.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite unanswered prayers of St. Peter. Lord, depart from me, for I'm a sinful man. And the Lord doesn't get out of the boat.
No.
Nope.
Why
sir.
Doesn't he get out? I said, Lord, get out of the boat. And he goes, no, I'm a sinner. I'm a savior. This is going to work out. Just follow me. Like, it's just like a beautiful.
Right.
Yeah. So, beautiful way the Lord comes close.
So I just want to make sure I make one key point about Trinity and Father's legacy. So Father talked about this centrality of the Jesus event, but he also said, I've never, you know, this is an idea for homily guys.
Yeah.
But I've never really heard a priest expound on this as much as Father did, was he said, you know, the first thing that Jesus did in his public ministry was create community. It's the very first thing he did.
Sure.
100%.
The first thing he did is we went out and he found 12 knuckleheads. And then second is, the second thing that he did is he spent time with them.
Mm.
Right.
That's it. So if the Lord and Savior of the universe his actions showed us what the priority in life should be, which is the first thing he did was he created his community. And mm-hmm. second is, mm-hmm. he spent time with them.
100%.
So all we do in Trinity Sober Homes is the best of our ability is to create that model.
Yeah.
And now with our new all-military sober house, Bravo Zulu House, same thing for our military brethren. But basically say is that, look, we want to put you in a community
hmm.
where you guys can just spend time with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to help you take away the gunk of the past.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to expose that spiritual ember.
Hmm.
And then you can call it anything you want. We call it the secret weapon, a.k.a. the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. You can call it the universe. You can call it whatever you want. But just mm-hmm. that this breath of life creates this spark
hmm.
of a flame. And if you guys have ever lived in a community,
mm-hmm.
you know, people ask me, well, what's a Catholic sober house like? I said, it's like Jesus meets Animal House, you know? That's yeah. basically what it is.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what awesome.
That?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
I would,
true.
I would say in seminary, but like, how's life in seminary? You know, everyone pursuing virtue and the Lord and prayer and all those different things. So I was like,
we're still men.
Go off your shoe size. That's yeah. about the. We got some 8-year-olds, we got some 12-year-olds, we got some 14-year-olds, but I mean, that's
that's your
college experience. Go off of your shoe size. That's as mature as
I might steal
we're
that.
Trying to work it. Yeah, go for it. It's yeah. one of my favorites.
Please do.
Go off your shoe size.
Yes, I like it.
That's
like
that's it. How you're acting right now. So, we just hit an hour.
Nice.
So, any last words? Anything?
Do you want
to talk about like where your houses are? Or?
Well, we have three of the Twin Cities, but okay. I would think the most important thing I want to say is thank you to you two gentlemen. You know, being a priest is not easy, and I think Brian, when I first met you, you know, I loved your initial reaction, which is stalker or really sincere guy. Jury's still out.
Still jury right? out. It's right? still out. No kidding.
It still is. Yes. Yeah. And so I think one of the things that those of us who have had the opportunity in life to be a leader, to run organizations, really cannot empathize but can sympathize with how challenging of a schedule you guys have, the challenging responsibilities, and also the hidden stuff. I mean, we get to see above the water. But the under the water stuff, there's loneliness, there's, you know, second guessing, there's the night of the dark soul with the Mother Teresa, like, what the hell am I doing?
Mm-hmm.
Is there really even a God? I mean, all of those things that come along with every human being, and you guys aren't exempt from that. And so, personally, I just say thank you, you know? I just know I couldn't do your jobs because I would just slap people. You know, you know, just sure. and I'm sure you want to on some days. You want to slap me? I get that. I should be slapped. So, that's the first thing. Is and the second is that I just am so proud of the fact that, you know, Father Martin Fleming, Colonel Father Martin Fleming, he saved my life, and I've been gifted a lot of things, and Father gave me the one gift that. The best gift one human being can give another is the gift of purpose.
Yes.
And my purpose in life is to help these men in the same way that Father helped me. Mm. And it's that one-liner. Go forth and do for others as I have done for you.
Yeah.
So I have this great miracle in my life, which is I get up every morning. I know exactly what I need to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how I'm going to do it, I got no clue.
Right?
We're going to figure that out.
Right.
But what is very clear. Yeah. And the nice thing is you guys know what you're supposed to do every day and how to do it is a journey.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Right. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming onto our podcast, and we'll make sure we'll put all of your details into our podcast too. So a quick shout out for you and Trinity Sober Homes as well. Yeah. For those listening out here, if you ever feel like this is kind of calling to you and you're looking for help, well, you know who to turn to. For God, but also the resources too as well. So
sweet. I think we might do another one on just looking through the 12 steps and maybe the 12 promises. So thanks for listening. What's my catchphrase? Oh, stay holy, my friends. Catch you later. Bye.